This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on today's episode, I'm chatting with author Osha Gray Davidson and Ruby Christmas. My definition of a hero is an ordinary person who shows great courage under extraordinary circumstances. And perhaps that is one of the reasons I was so moved a few weeks ago when I rented the movie The Best of Enemies. The unlikely friendship of Black community activist Ann Atwater and C.P. Ellis, exalted Grand Cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan, brought together to co-chair a series of meetings about the desegregation of Durham public schools in 1971, that seemed extraordinary to me. And it also must have seemed that way to writer Osha Gray Davidson, who documented Ann and CP's story in his book, The Best of Enemies, Race and Redemption in the New South. And that's where my conversation with Osha and Durham native Ruby Christmas begins.
When I first heard the story of Ann and CP, it was while I was reviewing Studs Terkel's book, Race, for a newspaper. And when there were only 8 pages devoted to it, because Studs Terkel did oral histories, so there are a lot of them in the book. And their story took up 8 pages, and I thought, somebody should write a book about this. And then I realized, well, that's what I do. Write books. So I called CP and Ann, and it took quite a while to get things going. But then I made several trips down here, stayed for weeks at a time, and got to know both of them and their families. And it was a fascinating story, and Durham's history is fascinating. And I'm glad that Ruby is here too, who lived through this. I mean, I just came down and researched it. I didn't live it. Makes all the difference in the world.
Well, and speaking of my friend Miss Ruby, you knew Ann Atwater, and you fought the fight. You were there at these charrettes. So tell me what she was like. I mean, we see her in the movie. We're going to see her on stage in a little bit. But what was she like as a person, as a mom?
She was a really nice person, but she was firm. She wanted what was right. She was straight up about everything. And you found strength in her. She didn't just roll over because you said so. And Ellis was cutting up out there at Duke and saying, "Our man of evil." And Anne is a Christian woman. I mean, she didn't wear a banner, but we would have meetings and we'd talk about things and we'd come back to the white people. They'd give us their input. And held firm to the things that she believed in, which caused a lot of things to happen. We were on the boards of directors at Operation Breakthrough, Head Start. We had a Sickle Cell Foundation. We had many, many, many meetings. Nobody even know I exist, I want you to know. So, I'm not dropping names. But that's what you have to know. They're unsung heroes.
Osha, what was CP like?
CP... By the time I knew him, he had already had this huge transformation. So it was hard to reconcile the man I knew with the man he had been. But that's the power of transformation. And it wouldn't have happened without Ann Atwater there. And it's astounding that she was able, it's through her faith entirely, that she was able to see past just the Klansman and see him as a human being and insist that he see her as a human being also. And CP was this great organizer, which I hate to say it, but that's why he was the head of the Klan. And once he left the Klan, he used those organizing skills for good. He became not non-racist, he became an anti-racist. And he worked with Ann, but he also worked inspired by Anne, he worked as a union organizer, the elected representative of a 80 to 90% black union for years, for the rest of his life, his working life. And he told me that his proudest accomplishment as a union organizer was he got the first Martin Luther King Day paid holiday in North Carolina.
He was the president of the Ku Klux Klan.
He was.
I mean, that's why this is an incredible story.
Right. But that says something about us, too, how we come to these things, that we don't believe in the possibility of change. We divide the world into, well, you're either a racist or a non-racist. And white progressive liberals have the hardest time making some kind of a transformation because they're hiding the racism that we all drew in as young people. We were raised in a white supremacist society. So it's impossible to not have those things in us. CP, on the other hand, he knew he was a racist. He was proud of it. He was the head of the Klan. So it was, in the one sense, but only a small sense, but it was easier in some way for him to make this transformation because once he saw through racism for what it was, which is a myth, that he had been used by the wealthy white to help separate blacks and whites so that the wealthy elite could maintain power in Durham. Once he saw through that, he told me that I asked him, you know, how could you do that? How could he make that kind of change? And he said, well, Osha, when you see the truth, you don't have a choice. Is that like, well, what can I do? I can't pretend that I believe these things that now I know aren't true.
Most people don't have that kind of transformation. When you interviewed him and spoke to him, what was in his character? There had to have been something in his DNA.
I think it was humanity. I don't think CP was any different from anybody else in a lot of ways. Especially, he wasn't different from white people in his racism, white people across the board, and he wasn't different from the rest of humanity and our capacity to change. And that's, to me, the moral of it that I didn't know until I'd been interviewing him and Anne and their families and all sorts of people down here for a long time, that this, although, yeah, it's a real dramatic change because he was the head of the Klan, but we all have that potential to change, to unlearn our racism, but first we have to acknowledge it, and that wasn't a problem for him. He had been acknowledging it all his life. And it was Anne who helped show him that none of this was true. Mm-hmm. White superiority was just a myth.
Mm-hmm. I never met him until the meeting that we had at R.N. Harris School.
The charrette.
Yes, you called it the charrette. I don't know why we called it that.
The guy who organized it, Bill Riddick.
Okay.
That's what he called it. Okay. And it's based on this idea of getting people together with different views.
Yes.
In an intense, concentrated situation.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, no, so that was the name of it.
Yeah, okay. It sure happened.
Well, Miss Reby, tell me about the meetings.
Well, they gave me a call and on this particular meeting to come over. They had called me a couple of times, and I don't particularly remember who exactly called me, but they told me to bring my son, and there were other kids who were working in the struggle as well. Head Start had just been maybe a year, not long, but little kids were talking. And they wanted to know from the kids, they wanted a variety of people, but they did not want the press there. So we changed places and ended up over here so we wouldn't have police and ride with the children there. And we sat at a table and they actually talked. And the talking to my son was almost like an afterthought. And I just remember what he said, and the kids had gone to speak, and he said he just didn't think it was right not to play with children. They were all children; we can get along, and that was way back then.
How old was your son?
He was all of four. I think if you count the time right, he's 167.
4 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good sense.
So those were the early meetings, because the charrette, that formal one, was in '71.
Except
but,
the one.
But there were a lot of other meetings.
That would be the one. He was 167, 68, 69, 77.
Oh, that's when he was born. My mistake. Got it.
7 years. So that first charrette
right.
is the one that we were,
right.
we attended.
The one thing that shocks me about this story is we're talking about 1971, which seems kind of late to be talking about integrating schools. Were we behind the eight ball?
Well, not when you compare it with the rest of the nation. And in fact, the schools are still as segregated now, at least as segregated, in some cases more segregated than they were back then. Brown v. Board came in 1954 that said, you know, you can't have separate but equal. It wasn't until the very early 70s that there were actually court cases pushing to do this. They found, the white supremacists found ways around this. And so, like always, there's the law mm-hmm. gets passed, and in this case, it's a court decision, and then it has to be enforced. And that takes a long time and a lot of hard work by a lot of people. So, yeah, that's the fact that it took that long says something. The fact that we're still nowhere close to achieving it says something else, says something more.
Ruby, one thing you said before we started, which really hit me, is we kind of got the history wrong. Mm-hmm. Durham wasn't a place of hate.
No.
Can you tell me what you meant by that?
So I realized that being born in 49, a lot of things had not changed. My father had just returned from the military. People were glad to see one another. We were glad to come home. We had dirt streets. Our dads they got jobs at the factory. Our parents went out to work as domestics. The factory used to blow a whistle, and we'd leave home to go off to work on our own because parents had to leave early. But when we went through white communities, they weren't fighting us. When they came over to us, we weren't fighting. And people didn't just ride up and down the street and were mean to one another. My grandmama and I, we could care less if folks was white. We sat on the same porch to shell peas together, ate fish in the kitchens. This mess of Durham not getting along is really for the bull.
Did the Ku Klux Klan have a big presence here?
They did, but it was under CP, it was expressed differently than under some other people. But there have been different Klans at different periods. But the thing that Ruby was saying, I think, is it touches on how subtle some of these things are that we've made so simple when they're really complex. You're talking about how, you know, that there wasn't hate and interpersonal relationships. Institutionalized racism was there.
Yeah.
The black infant mortality rate back then was a lot higher than the white infant mortality rate. You were talking about the streets not being paved. Mm-hmm. None of the black streets were paved, and the poor white streets weren't paved. The power structure was still held mostly, and this is what, I mean, I didn't live here. A lot of this came from Anne, that she had her problems with the top people at the North Carolina Mutual, and it wasn't a race thing, it was a class thing.
That's right.
There was race and there was class separately and then together. So it makes the whole story much more complex, where people can be nice to you, and yet Florence Blakely, I don't know if you knew her.
I've heard her name.
She was the head information librarian at Duke University, a white woman who passed several years ago now, unfortunately, but she was a big help to me when I was doing research. And we were having lunch one day, and I said something about, boy, everybody here is so nice. They're, you know, it's so polite and nice. And she said she hated that about the South because that she said that's a way that white people have been covering up the damage that we do to black people forever. And we insist on a politeness because politeness masks this level of disrespect that's underneath it.
We call it sugar tit.
Right. So it's, I'm not saying anything contrary to what Ruby's saying. I'm just saying
that's one part that needs to be stressed. And then there's this other part that needs to be stressed, that the power elite in Durham was keeping poor black people and poor white people down, just like everywhere else in the United States, and keeping them at each other's throats. Mm-hmm. It was the largest banks that loaned money to CP to the Klan for the Klan Hall. It was the police department who told CP when there's going to be a black rally, a march, the police would give CP a map of where the permit allowed black people to march so that the Klan could show up and threaten them and maybe commit violence.
It's incredible because those stories still take place today. My dad was the city attorney of the city of Miami Beach when the Holocaust Memorial was built. And on the day that the Holocaust Memorial was going to be open there, of course, you had all of these Holocaust survivors at that time who had rallied to build this beautiful monument, and the Klan petitioned to be there as well. And the government had to allow them, you know, they had to have the same rights to show up as everybody else. And it was hard for my Jewish lawyer dad to make those decisions.
Anne was a good example of someone like you said, who, you put it so mildly and nicely, that she didn't take stuff from people. God help you if you went up against Anne Atwater.
That's right. She had a backbone.
She had several backbones.
I love people enough. Like that.
And she was the nice force, the loving, not nice, loving force. She wouldn't sacrifice. She didn't feel she had to give up one for the other. So she stood firm against racism, against any kind of racial injustice. And at the same time, she did it from a place of love. And you might not know it if you were on the receiving end of the phone that she threw at you, because she would do that. But, you know, she was human. She knew that. She gave in to some human impulses like that. But most of the time, what she did is she responded firmly, no nonsense, but based in love, but it was love of justice. Mm-hmm. And that can be a fierce force.
Osha's book inspired a play written by Mark St. Germain and the movie, which premiered in Durham earlier this year. Osha had never seen the play in person until last night when he saw the production presented at North Carolina Central University, which is in the heart of Durham. He sat next to CP's grandson and afterwards said, quote, "I miss Anne and CP. So seeing them together was emotional because they're real people to me. To be here under these circumstances is pretty mind-blowing." CP passed away in 2005. Anne gave the eulogy at his funeral. She passed away in 2016. The North Carolina Central University Theater production of The Best of Enemies play closes this weekend, but Osha's book is available in paperback and audio format on Amazon if you want to learn more about this story. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to the podcast, follow us on social media at RDU on Stage, consider becoming a patron, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next week, I'll see you at the theater.